480 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim, after the Exodus from Egypt, in the 9th century before the Common Era, the Jewish Commonwealth reached its zenith. It reached the highest point that it has ever achieved in its history. And that was under the reign of Solomon, the son of David, Shlomo HaMelech. It achieved the highest point economically, imperially, in terms of the land that it controlled and the alliances that it had. It was the strongest military power, the strongest social power, the strongest economic power in the area. And the entire world beat a path to Jerusalem. So that, in effect, it was the center of the intellectual world, it was the center of everything. The problem with being on top is that after that there's only one way to go. And that will happen in the lifetime of Shlomo HaMelech himself. A rabbi say, Yo'eh Aniyusa LiYisrael. Poverty, troubles, problems, they are befitting the Jewish people. There are many interpretations of that, but one of the basic interpretations is that at least it's something we know how to handle. We have long experience. And therefore, troubles are not unexpected, and we are able to deal with them somehow. But success, that's a very heady wine. That's a very, very difficult thing to be able to deal with. And success on the nature that Shlomo HaMelech achieved success, so even a person as great as Shlomo and a nation as great as the Jewish people were unable to stand that success. So we are talking about a window of time in about the year 900, 880, 860, in that area of time before the Common Era, where all of the dreams and all of the promises of the Chumash and the Rabboni Shalom, so to speak, to the Jewish people, all were fulfilled. And the prediction that the Jewish people would be unable to digest it, unable to deal with it, also was fulfilled. Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivot. The Jewish people waxed fat, they waxed great, Vayivot, and they started to kick. We have many psychological ideas advanced in the Talmud, but that's one recurring theme over and over again. And that is that Ein Ari Noheim Mitoch Kupo Shel Teven Ela Mitoch Kupo Shel Bosar. A lion does not roar if he's eating straw. A lion roars only when he's eating steak. And that parable is meant to transpose on the Jewish people as well. That the Jewish people, when they have too much steak, so then they roar too much. And when they roar too much, so then the world roars back. Then every action begets a reaction. This one does as well. And that, therefore, I think is the hallmark of whatever we can say about probably one of the greatest personages that ever lived in the history of civilization, King Solomon, is that he's such a complex character that the ambivalence toward him in the Tanakh and in the Talmud and in the words of the rabbis is so great that it's hard to get a handle on him. You can read one whole series of Midrashim and say that he was the worst person in the world, as I'm going to point out certain Midrashim to us. You read another set of Midrashim, he was the greatest man in the world. Both sets are true. And he is not a simple person to have to deal with. And because of the fact that he is that complex, and because of the fact that he does not allow for any easy definition, He is one of the most difficult heroes the Jewish people have. David, we have seen in my brilliant lecture last week, so we all now know about David. So we were able to see that David, in spite of his problems, he comes through as David, who is the warrior, the hero of Israel, the great poet, the great emotional person, the person who is bound up with his inextricable faith, inseparable faith, rather, with God. And that in spite of whatever one could say negatively, David is a positive figure. He's probably the most positive figure in the Tanakh. But you can't say that about Shlomo, because Shlomo is much more complex. It's much harder to deal with. Too many things happen. And he's a reflection, as every person is. Every person is a reflection of the time that he or she lives in, and every person influences the time that he or she lives in. Well, that's Shlomo. Shlomo is a reflection of the greatness and of the impending doom of the Jewish people. And he contributes to the greatness, and he contributes to the impending doom. And he himself, therefore, is a story of greatness and a story of impending doom. I think that with that background, we can have some sort of insight or understanding into the events that are recorded for us. We have very little written records, again, regarding this period of time. The periods of time when the Jews were in dominance in the ancient world are those periods of time in which almost nothing was written. The Jews never wrote history. There's a great theory about that. There's a marvelous book called Zachor by a professor Yerushalmi, who was a professor, I think, of Jewish studies in Columbia University. I don't know if he's an Israeli. I haven't figured it out yet whether he's an Israeli who's gone right or an Israeli who's gone wrong, but he's gone. It's different. It's a small book. It's published by University of Washington Press. It's a series of four lectures on Jewish history. And one of the lectures, he discusses why Jews never wrote history. And I think he hits the nail right on the head. And that is because Jews never felt the necessity for writing history, because history was always alive. We're going to sit down at the Seder for Pesach. It's not a historic event. It's happening now. My children, my grandchildren, everybody is there. We are not, commits not the 4th of July. It's Pesach and Matzah and more. It's all happening now. And therefore, it's a different type of history. Just like the 9th of Av sitting on the floor in Shul is not a commemoration. It's happening now. It's all the troubles of the Jewish people are poured into the event now. Because of that, Jews never wrote history. A great deal of history was written about the Jews. But it was written about the Jews mainly by their conquerors or their enemies, or those who wanted to show what happened to the Jews because they were allegedly non-believers, etc., etc. It is only in the last 150 years that any Jewish history, so to speak, has been written. And again, it's been written from the detractors of Judaism, basically. But Jews of faith, Jews of belief, Jews who were practicing Jews, they were not interested in history, because what did they need history for? By word of mouth, by tradition, by legend, we know everything. So why should we bother to write it down in a book? Well, that is changing now, even in the traditional Jewish world. The importance of history or some sort of texts, etc., simply because of the nature of our world, now is understood. And in Israel especially, a great deal is being written and has been written and undoubtedly will be written. But Shlomo never saw fit to write a history book about himself. And the people whom he defeated never saw any reason to record that either. And therefore, whenever the Jewish people are in a role of ascendancy, in a mode of power, there's almost nothing written about them. And most of the Jewish history that we have from the ancient world is from the enemies of the Jewish people at the time of the destruction of the Jewish people, or at the time of their troubles, when they are recorded as victories in the annals of the other nations, of the other countries. So what we know about Shlomo, we know from the Tanakh primarily, and secondarily we know from the words of the rabbis. The rabbis reflect the oral tradition regarding the person, the legends regarding the person, the historic memory of the Jewish people. There is something called a general historic memory that the Jewish people have. The Jewish people as a whole remember everything because they were there for everything. They were witnesses to everything. So therefore, the Jewish people as a whole remember everything. Not every Jew remembers it, and not every faction or segment of the Jewish people remember, but the Jewish people as a whole, they have a collective memory. This is the collective memory regarding Shlomo HaMelech. And the collective memory regarding Shlomo HaMelech, as I pointed out to you, is self-contradictory. It is heroic and it is accusatory. It is grandeur and nobility and wisdom and piety. And it is smallness and pettiness and base desires and self-destruction, all wrapped up into one. And that's what makes it so difficult to deal with. Our rabbis say, and again, I'm not telling you my personal opinion. That's the last lecture. But all the 100 and some lectures till now is not my personal opinion. So what I'm going to tell you in this lecture are a series of midrashim. And again, I'm not going to be able to reconcile them, but I think that when we're done, we'll have a picture of Shlomo. A rabbi say that the... That God wanted to consign Shlomo, so to speak, to Gehenna, to hell. Write him off the list, as I'm certain there were many Jews who also were willing to do that because of his failings. Except that the angel said, the man that built the temple in Jerusalem, the man that built the Beis HaMikdash, that schus alone, that merit alone that he built God's house, so they elevated him. In that short vignette that the rabbis is the whole story. Here's the man who builds the house of God. That's the culmination of Jewish existence. David HaMelech wanted to do it, and God didn't give him the permission to do so. His son Shlomo rises to the occasion, builds the temple in Jerusalem, which is invested with the physical manifestation, so to speak, of God's presence. The holy aura of the Rabboni Shalom is there. The Shechina descends. All the miracles that are promised for the Beis HaMikdash occur. It is the wonder of the ancient world. There's no doubt that Shlomo's on God's side, and God is on Shlomo's side. That investment, so to speak, that Shlomo made in his early years, he cannot dissipate even in his later years. There are some people who are fortunate enough that they make enough money when they are young that even when they... usually by luck, or by inheritance, or by other methods, that later on when they become great businessmen, they still can't lose enough. At the end, they still have a few dollars left, because they started with such a fortune. And spiritually, that's how the rabbi saw Shlomo. He couldn't spend it. It isn't that he didn't try. But he couldn't spend it. And because he couldn't spend it, then he was, he is listed in the great men of the Jewish people. But you'll see that he, in certain things, he's excluded. He's not one of the Ushpizin that visit us on Sukkot. David is, Shlomo isn't. When he's mentioned in Slichas and when he's mentioned in other things, it's always as the son of David, David is Shlomo Beno, because like he needs David to carry him along. Because again, there's that ambivalent relationship. Shlomo was 12 years old when he succeeded to the throne. It's interesting. The first Mishkan was built by Bezalel when Bezalel became Bar Mitzvah. You should never take a Bar Mitzvah boy lightly. He doesn't, so why should you? So he built the Mishkan, and Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash. He started when he was 13 years old. There is a lesson there too. And the purity and the enthusiasm of youth and all of that is encompassed there. He reigned for 40 years. He died at the age of 52, just as Shmuel died at the age of 52. The first 4 years of his reign were the great years of his reign. That was the time when he asked for the gift of wisdom that God bestowed upon him. His wisdom was not only an intellectual wisdom, which he had, which made him the wisest of all men, but God gave him wisdom. The rabbis say he understood nature. He could hear the birds speak. He understood their language. He understood intuitively all sorts of things. Our rabbis say that Shlomo in his court, in his Bezdin, did not need witnesses. The halacha is that no judge decides a matter without two witnesses. The witnesses have to say what happened. In Shlomo's case, he decided without witnesses. It says, Vayeshev Shlomo al Kisei Hashem. Shlomo sat on God's throne, meaning the throne of Israel. But our rabbis say God's throne, he had a conduit, he had a pipe. For various reasons, our rabbis say nobody ever dared lie to him. That's the famous legend that he had two lions at the side of his, two golden lions at the side of his throne, on either side of the throne. And that if someone lied, then the lions came to life. The lions were able to smell out the imposter, the charlatan, the sycophant, the person that was insincere. That's frightening to have a king like that. And it's not human nature to be able to bear it. I mentioned to you when we discussed the Ari that the legend of the Ari concerning Rabbi Yitzchak Luria is that by looking at a person he could tell what averis that person had. So people stopped coming to visit him. Because that, right, that is the human reaction. It's like people don't want to go to a dentist, or they're afraid to go to a doctor, or other thing that we know we should go, but our nature is to avoid the problem. Well, spiritually also our nature is to avoid the problem. So Solomon, because of his intuitive greatness, could not achieve that type of popularity. I'll give you an example of two completely conflicting ideas regarding the time of Solomon. The Talmud tells us, the Talmud, the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, and the Gemara in Yevamos also, the Talmud tells us that during the reign of King David and King Solomon, the Jewish people did not accept converts. And the reason for not accepting converts is that One of the tests of a convert to Judaism is that you say to him, the Beis Din says to him, do you realize that the Jewish people are a persecuted people? You realize that in the world, becoming a Jew is a problem. And by impressing that fact upon him, that's a test of his sincerity or her sincerity. As it has been proven so many times through Jewish history, that when terrible anti-Semitic governments came into power, usually they went after the converts first. Those non-Jews, a non-Jew to convert to Judaism, in most of the history of the Jewish people, was an automatic death sentence. If the person was caught and tried, then that's what it was. It was that way in Spain, it was that way in Central Europe, it was that way in Poland, and in the Muslim countries, a Muslim that converted to Judaism, I mean, that's the end. So that is a powerful test of sincerity. In our time and in our country, at least until now, that's not such a powerful test. Though it is somewhat of a test. It is still somewhat of a test. I would, most people in the United States would still rather come from good WASP heritage and be a member in the Episcopalian Church than to be Goldberg from the Lower East Side. Well, that's true. It works the other way around, too, that a Jew that converts to Christianity, he is a man without a country, usually. But our rabbis say, therefore, during the reign of David and Solomon, when the Jewish empire was at its zenith, and when everything was, the temple was built, and it was everything, it was just, it didn't take much to be a Jew. You came to Jerusalem, everybody wanted to be Jewish. How could you not want to be Jewish? So that's the opinion that's mentioned in the Talmud. However, there's a Mishnah to Rabbi Elazar, a famous Medrash, that says that during the reign of Solomon, 150,000 non-Jews converted to Judaism. How do you reconcile the two? Well, the Talmud holds that a non-Jew that converts, even illegally, becomes Jewish. That's part of the problem. Maybe we shouldn't say it publicly, but, it's like getting into the Super Bowl, right? I mean, once you're in, you're in. Very, very few people are thrown out by the ushers. The job is to get past the guy that's collecting the tickets. The job is to get past the turnstile. But once you've done that, you can circulate, right? From my ancient days, and I remember, again, Chalamei at Pesach, everybody, the whole yeshiva, we used to go to Cubs ballpark to watch the Cubs open the season, another great losing season. And, in fact, there were so many Jewish kids there, you could hear the crunch of the matzah in the stadium, in the ballpark. It's a small ballpark. And they're not, and they're in the middle, and they play in the afternoon, so like 15,000 people are there, right? So 5,000 are eating matzah, so you could hear it. But sometimes there were guys that didn't have the 50 cents to get in. You needed 50 cents for the bleachers, so they would get in also, right? They figured out a way, they would all get in, and somehow everybody got in one way or another. Once you're in, then nobody ever threw you out of the bleachers. There was no, were no seats assigned or anything. That was it. You were in. Well, in a, I'm not trying to make it as light as that, but to a certain extent in halacha, that applies to converts also. Once you're in, it's hard to get you out. That's part of the furor about conversion today. The furor is to prevent the conversion at its onset and to make it halachically acceptable. Because we who follow halacha are aware that once they get in, they're in. It's difficult to uproot them, difficult to say they're not Jews. So I have often thought that that probably is the reconciliation of these two things, that the official policy was not to accept converts. And that if you went to the main big Bote Dinim, to the main big courts in Israel, they wouldn't accept. But somehow 150,000 got in. That's a lot of people, 150,000. But again, it shows us the grandeur of the time. The second time when so many converts became Jewish was the end of the Greek Empire and the beginning of the Roman Empire, when paganism began to dissolve completely and the grandeur of Judaism and Jewish ideas, etc., came into the world. There was a mass movement then of conversion as well. But this is, I think, the largest single, in a short period of time, the largest single number of gerim, of converts, that ever came into the Jewish people. For good or for better, that's a different problem. But historically, that's undoubtedly what happened. And Shlomo HaMelech had relations with the entire world. Our rabbis tell us that the wise men of Greece, the Chachmei Atuna, the wise men of Athens, were disciples of Solomon. Solomon taught them mathematics, engineering, most of the things that the Greeks, philosophy. He taught them that. In the Jewish world, that didn't go for much, because the Jewish world was basically Torah and faith. But the abstract, theoretical, esoteric subjects of intellect in the world, the Talmud saw that the Greeks were indirect disciples of Solomon. It is therefore, again, my theory, but I've heard it from others, and I have a sixth sense that it's correct. It's therefore understandable why the Jews were attracted to these things and why a large section of the Jewish people, even of the traditional Jewish people, dealt with it and didn't feel, the Rambam didn't feel that Aristotle was a foreigner to him. Because Aristotle, what's good in Aristotle belongs to Solomon. I think that that's an important insight. And therefore, the Jews didn't feel that they were borrowing from foreign fields. It was just, we find the same idea in the Chumash, that when Avraham Avinu wanted to separate Yitzchak from all of his other children whom he had, from Hagar, from Keturah later, etc. So it says that to the Bnei Apilakshim, to the children of the other wives, he gave them gifts and he sent them away. So among the many explanations of the gifts that he gave them intellect, he gave them sciences, he gave them certain powers, physical powers, powers regarding purity and impurity, all sorts of things he gave to them. But generations later, Yitzhak's children would feel that these things are not foreign to them because it all came from their father Abraham. It was originally Jewish in origin. I think that that's what makes the Jewish people so universal and so eclectic and so interested in everything and so talented in everything, is simply because of the fact that somehow it all originally stems from the greatness of the Jewish people. So Shlomo is the one that did it. For instance, according to the Zohar, Hiram, the king of Tyre, the man who helped Shlomo build the Beis HaMikdash, was a pagan originally, and Shlomo convinced him intellectually to give up paganism. He became what we call a Ger Toshov, which is a non-Jew that accepts upon himself the basic premises of the Jewish Weltanschauung, not that he observes mitzvahs, but the Jewish system regarding stealing and murder and belief in God and an ordered society and civilization, he accepted civilization upon himself. And then the Zohar says, that's why it says, Vayhi Sholom Bein Hiram Uvein Shlomo. there was peace between Hiram and Shlomo. So the simple explanation is there were peace, that they were allies. They didn't go to war. He was like the king of Lebanon, and Shlomo was the king of Israel. So they had the good fence between them. But the Zohar tells us a much deeper insight, that the word Shalom means there was harmony of thought. They viewed the world in the same fashion. Shlomo had a profound influence upon everybody that came to meet him. And that's why monarchs, the Queen of Sheba and others, monarchs came from all over the world to meet him and to discuss matters with him. He was the seminal person in the world, the person of ideas, the person of thoughts, the person of great influence. There's a whole medrash that brought in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, that when the Queen of Sheba came, she asked him three riddles and he solved the riddles for her. She was so impressed with his wisdom. But the problem with being great is that one believes in himself. You have to. And when one believes in himself, then it's not hard to get tripped up. The beginning of the demise of Shlomo HaMelech is 4 years after he becomes the king, he marries the daughter of the Pharaoh. So our rabbis say he converted her. He didn't marry a non-Jewish woman. She converted, and that she herself was a great person, and that it was politically expedient, as many of the marriages in the ancient world were, and even in our time, political marriages, diplomatic marriages, royal marriages are not always contracted on the basis of the bride and groom alone, but there are other factors that exist. But he married Bas Paro. Our rabbis see that as the high water mark of the Jewish people and of Shlomo. From that point on, it's downhill. Our rabbis say that on the day that he married the daughter of Paro, an angel came and he inserted a reed in the ocean. That's the language of the rabbis. And that reed became the city of Rome. Meaning the destruction of the Jewish people, 800 years later, he precipitated it. You don't marry the daughter of Paro without it having far-reaching cosmic consequences. And our rabbis say that it says in the Book of Kings in Melachim, Ein kesef lo nechshav bimei Shlomo meuma, that the prosperity amongst the Jewish people was of such a nature that money, wealth, silver didn't count for anything. It was Borough Park in the ultimate. Didn't mean anything. No value. And then it says, Vayitein Shlomo sakeser b'Yerushalayim ka'avonim, that Shlomo took the silver in Jerusalem and he stored it away. So rabbis say, well, what is it? Was it worth or wasn't it worth? So the Talmud and Sanhedrin says, no, it depends. Before he married the daughter of Paro, the money played no role. After he married the daughter of Paro, things changed. And it's a pattern throughout the rabbis. Before Bas Paro, after Bas Paro. That was the cross the line. His great wisdom undid him. Al techkam harbe, Shlomo said. Don't be too wise. Lomo chachamta. Right? He said it about himself. I always say that about the New York Times, though. Not only am I changing papers, but I... You read the Times, you know too much. I mean, I got up in the morning, I was perfectly happy without knowing that there was a landslide in Botswana yesterday. I'm depressed, I finished the newspaper, because I know too much. I'm not obligated to know every trouble in the world, right? It's enough that I've got 36 Carlton Road. I'm not, I can't. He knew too much. Too wise. Too wise. In life, almost too much of anything is not a blessing. Too much of wisdom undid him too. And he therefore saw himself above the law, which also happens to great people. It happens to presidents of the United States in the last 40, 50 years. It happened almost to every president. I'm certain to every president. They're above the law. They're above the Constitution. They're above, and they do it, right? Yeah. And then later on, either they explain it or they cover it up or they get impeached, but whatever happens, because if you're the most powerful person in the world and you can press the button that can blow up the whole world, so what do you mean? I'm not going to do it because the Constitution says no. I know better than the Constitution. Those guys are dead for 200 years. They don't know what I'm facing. They don't know what's doing in Watergate or what's doing in Iran or what's doing in Nicaragua or what's doing anywhere, right? I have to make the decision, and I was elected, and I'm smart, and I have all the facts, and I do it. So that's true regarding human law, and Shlomo made that true regarding divine law as well. The Torah, it says, the king shouldn't have too much money. Rak lo yar belo kesef. You don't have to do it yourself if you have too much money. I had such a pleasure today. Two kids from the yeshiva came to clean the car. Right, so we won't discuss the type of job that was done, but they came, they worked an hour for $6, and you know, to clean the car for Pesach. Now, both of those children, they don't need the $6. There are lots of kids that for $6 wouldn't walk across the street for you. No, what's $6? I have a closet full of clothing left over by children. Designer clothing. I mean, what? Overcoats, jackets, ties. Nobody ever claims it. You go out and buy another clothes, right? So I was delighted that a kid's willing to work for $6. It's a sign that the Torah says kings shouldn't have too much money. Too much money is bad news. It's bad news for a king. Alachas kama v'kama for lowly commoners. It affects you. It's not a neutral thing, money. Solomon said, well, it doesn't mean me, you know, they mean the other kings, right? But me, I'm the smartest, you know, and I can decide things without witnesses, and I know what the birds say, and I built the Beis HaMikdash, and I've got God's ear, so to speak, and I'm a holy and pious person, and I know better, right? So nothing's going to happen to me. Happened. The Torah said, not too many wives for kings. The Oriental potentates, and today you have it among the Muslim monarchs, etc. Harems, women without end. And the Torah had said, Rak lo yar belo noshim, you shouldn't have too many wives. Because all rumors to the contrary, notwithstanding, there is a limit to how many women a man can handle. And they'll destroy him. And Solomon said, not me, right? He had 1,000 wives, it says in the Tanakh, the Medrash, he had 1,000 wives. The Medrash says that he had a dream of having 20,000 children. The Medrash says tremendous things about him, you know, that he intended, really it's modern genetics. He wanted to make geniuses. Just like you have these ideas that walk around today, right? That they're going, you know, it'll be like a supermarket. You pick out a blue-eyed with 170 IQ that can bat left-handed. Right? That's the one you want, right? He had that idea. I mean, there are no new ideas in the history of the world. And technology may be new, it may not be new, I don't know. But the idea is not new.
So he says he'll have 1,000 wives. No problem, no problem. They destroyed him. And the Torah had said that he shouldn't have too great an army, not too many horses, because he'll be dependent upon Egypt. He'll be dependent upon others. You have a big army. The army runs itself. It has its own life. It eats up everything. Look, most of the money in the world is spent on armies. There's no single item in any budget in the world that equals the budget for what we euphemistically call defense. Estimated by economists and by political scientists that more than half of the world's wealth, year in and year out, is invested in all of these things, all of which become obsolete in a year or two. And the mentality that provokes, see, if God forbid peace were declared tomorrow, and there was a disarmament, you know, everybody, the prophet's Isaiah's great dream that all the spears will be broken into plowshares, the stock market will collapse. Everybody be out of a job. So there is a self-interest to keep these things going. So the Torah said, no, you know, don't do that. Don't have too many horses. Horses is the symbol of this. And he said, no problem. That's somebody else, not me. I can deal with Egypt. And he ended up that Egypt dealt with him. He had to marry the daughter of the king of Egypt. And he had to make compromises and alliances. And he lost out because he was greater than the law. And because he was greater than the law, the law eventually caught up to him. Shlomo did great things. Our rabbis say that there never was a day that the Lord rejoiced as the day that Shlomo HaMelech made the takona regarding Erevin, an imaginary fence, so to speak, around the city or around the community to be able to allow people to carry on Shabbos, which in our time has become popular again. And it's part of the resurgence of the Jewish people in our time. Well, that's Shlomo HaMelech's invention. And according to the Talmud and Shabbos, a voice from heaven came and said, Yismach libi gamoni. You were so smart to do the right thing, I rejoice with you. God, Kaviyochel, rejoiced with it. Our mitzvah of Netilas Yodayim, of washing our hands before bread, that's Shlomo HaMelech's takona. Shlomo's the one that was masakin. Rabbon Shalom said also, what a tremendous, and if you'll think about it, the genius that lies in that simple act. So I'm not only talking about the cleanliness, which I cannot emphasize that if we're not for the mitzvahs which breed some sort of hygienic conditions into the Jewish people, we would be filthy. Because downtrodden people, manners never played a great role because there was no time for social graces. There was no... And yet, the halacha, which is what governs us and makes us a great people, forced it upon us. Can't eat without washing your hands. You go to the bathroom, you'll excuse me, you have to wash your hands. You know, always makes me nervous. You go into a restaurant or something, you know, they got signs all over, employees must wash their hands. You know, that's like the signs in a shul. Everybody should be quiet during Kriyas HaTorah. When you see that sign, you know it's a noisy shul. You see the signs all over the place that they got to wash their hands. You know, they're not washing their hands. And I'm eating from it. And I'm paying for eating from it, too. In halacha, you don't have to put up the sign. They don't have to put up the sign, you know, that employees have to, if all the workers in the restaurant are shomrei mitzvahs, you don't have to put up a sign in the bathroom that you have to wash your hands. So that genius, and also the act of sanctification of eating, it's a remarkable thing. You're on the plane, and they serve food, you know, and the Jews, so they got to get up, they got to wash, they got to do, they go on El Al in the morning, and everybody gets up from the hour of fitful sleep, and everybody's looking for cups to wash, it's going on. So on one hand, you know, the poor stewardess, it's not her fault, but on the other hand, it's a remarkable testament to people. He's got to wash his hands, you know. The rest of the world doesn't wash their hands. What do they have to wash their hands for? Because it lends to us an aura of greatness, of holiness. And Shlomo's instinct in that was unerring. That's why God said, "Gam libi gam yismach libi gam oni." I'm also rejoicing. Great. Shlomo is the one that gave us the fourth paragraph of Benchin. Rachim no Hashem Elokeinu al Yisrael amecho v'yishalayim yirecho v'atziyu mishkan v'alavayis ha'godol v'akodosh. That's Shlomo HaMelech's Nusach. He's the one that put it into the Birchas HaMozon, to the grace after meals, and the bracha of Bonei Yerushalayim, that's Shlomo HaMelech's bracha. And Shlomo HaMelech was the most charitable of all men. Shlomo HaMelech was mentioned in Bava Basra as being the person that gave away everything. And he set the example for it. He felt that it was wrong for a wealthy society, especially, to have poverty-stricken people. And a person that gives his money to the poor, tzidkoso omedes la'ad, Shlomo said. His righteousness, his goodness is eternal. There is no limit to that. All of the great questions in halacha of the time, Shlomo decided. Shlomo established an educational system that was the envy of the entire world and that the Jewish people have never equaled. A number of kings restored it almost to his level. But there was no such thing as illiteracy among the Jewish people, and certainly not illiteracy in terms of Torah knowledge. And Shlomo was the example of it. The Talmud tells us one of the great stories. Shlomo had a mother, Bas Sheva, the original Jewish mother. And he was, she got him the job. She lobbied hard and got him the job. That's what the Tanakh tells us. And she was alive during most of his reign, and she was the one person that he was frightened of. The Talmud has a description how, once he didn't get up in the morning for the minyan, she told him, what kind of king, you know, that's the goyim get up at 10 in the morning. What's with you? And he also had a great Rebbe who, as long as his teacher was alive, so then he did not marry the daughter of Paro. He didn't go off the road. When his Rebbe died, so then the troubles began. It's interesting. The Medrash tells us, in Vayikra Rabba, the Medrash tells us that he had an arch rival, Yeravam ben Nevot, who was one of the great men of Israel and a great Talmud Chacham, but who in the lifetime of Shlomo already aspired to the throne. He saw that Shlomo was declining, and he saw that Shlomo's son Rechavam was not the father and not the grandfather, and he was a man of vaulting ambition, and he was a great Talmud Chacham, and he had the support. He was a student of Achio Ashiloni, who was the Rebbe of Elio Anovi. He had the support of great prophets. So his attack on Shlomo was based on the fact that Shlomo wasn't religious enough. his attack on Shlomo was based on the fact that Shlomo, in the words of the Medrash, he organized a group of people to come and chastise Shlomo regarding his behavior. Imagine walking into the king and telling him, you know, yeah, you weren't the dominion, you know, and you missed the Seder for learning, and you're not really what you're supposed to be in terms of being a Jew. And Shlomo accepted it from him, which is to the greatness of Shlomo. But God has ears, and this man Yerovam, who chastises Shlomo because of the fact that he didn't meet his standards, will be the man that will bring idolatry to the Jewish people, and because of his own lust for power. And Choto v'hechti es Yisrael, he is assigned in the Talmud to the lower regions immediately. He sinned and he made the entire Jewish people sin. He's the man that broke the Jewish kingdom into two. He's one of the villains in the history of the Jewish people. But that isn't how a villain begins his career. A villain begins his career as being self-righteous, as being able to criticize the king for his failings, and being able to point out, you know, we don't have such a religious rabbi by us. And all of these human qualities, the intensely human qualities, come into play. Shlomo left us with a legacy of three great books that are really the books of the Jewish people. One is the great Song of Songs, the Shir HaShirim, the song of the love of God in Israel, which Shlomo wrote in one of the most magnificent pieces of human poetry ever put to paper. Book that's inspired by divine inspiration, and the book that is representative of the relationship between God and Israel, and the only way that representation can even reach a metaphorical state is to represent it and to represent it in the love between a man and a woman, which in the Talmud is seen as the ultimate expression of human physical love and of the longing of one for each other and of the relationship of one. So Kaviyochel in the Shir HaShirim, God is portrayed, Kaviyochel, as though such a thing could be, as being the man and the Jewish people are the woman. And the long history of the Jewish people is this, for lack of a better word, you won't misunderstand what I'm saying, but it's this soap opera, right? The lovers getting together again. That's Shir HaShirim, the great Song of Songs. And Rabbi Akiva said, and the Talmud agrees, that if the rest of the Torah is holy, then Shir HaShirim is the holy of holies. It's the ultimate expression. And only he, that's if that gift alone assures his immortality. It's interesting, the rabbis comment that his temple was destroyed and his empire was destroyed, and the great throne and the great palace and the golden lions, all of that was destroyed, but his books live on forever. Shir HaShirim Asher Li Shlomo, the Song of Songs that is Solomon's. His second book is Mishle, the Proverbs of Solomon. Shlomo had many names, seven names. One of the names is Lemuel. The Talmud darshans each and every one of the names to explain why he was called Yedidya. He had seven names. But the book of Mishle has tremendous wisdom in it that has remained till today. The book of Proverbs, it is the book of human wisdom. And it's the book of Jewish wisdom. If you want to really understand the Jewish opinion of civilization, of the world, of people, to understand Jewish psychology, the view of human relationships, how people should deal with each other, that's in the book of Mishle. And the book of Mishle has been imitated many times. The closest imitation is the book of Ben Sira, which is also called Mishle Ben Sira. Ben Sira was the son of the prophet Yirmiyahu, And his book was so close to being on target that there was a debate among the rabbis whether it should be included in the Bible. Eventually, it was excluded, and it's part of the Jewish Apocrypha. But it is quoted many, many times in the Talmud, and it was a book that was very well known. Its popularity is based upon the fact that it is an intensely accurate and convincing mimicry of the Book of Proverbs. And finally, his third book is the great book of Kehelis, Ecclesiastes, which is the most difficult book to deal with. It's so difficult to deal with that the Talmud tells us that the rabbis wanted to exclude it from the canon of the Bible. Because on the surface, there are many self-contradictions. If you take verses out of context, it looks like he says things that are heretical. You have to take the book as a whole. And then the rabbis decided in their ultimate wisdom that we'll let the book stand, and whoever wants to be a darn fool about it, we can't help it. Which is really the only way to deal in life. There is no Shulchan Aruch for darn fools. There is no way to prevent it. And if one has to always worry about how misinterpreted and foolish people will be about creativity and other sorts of things, then it's a sorry world that never can advance. And in order to prevent that, Kehelis is the prime example. Kehelis, it can be said, is the first book of Jewish philosophy. And it's the first book of Jewish philosophy because what it does is take all of the other philosophies of the world that were present at the time, hedonism, fatalism, even what later on was the Epicurean philosophy and other types of philosophy, and it discusses them. And the pattern of the book is to take the other philosophies and draw them out to their finally illogical conclusion. All philosophy is good up to a point. When you cross that point, so then it no longer does it. It cannot, there's no philosophy that can explain everything. There's no philosophy that works in every circumstance. So then the failure of a philosophy is itself its success. You want to apply it, so you apply it to 100 situations, it works. It's the same thing true in the physical world. The first 100 times it works, and then the 101st time it doesn't work. So now you've struck on a new theory. You've seen a new pattern. Well, in philosophy, that's what happens too. I always tell you the bad joke, which is really accurate about philosophy, is the philosopher who's dying, and his disciple asks him, what great master, what are your last words? So he says, you know, my philosophy is that life is a river. Oh, life is a river. And he tells it to all the disciples gathered around the master's deathbed. Comes all the way in the back of the room, a little guy says, hey, what does he mean, life is a river? And the question comes back all the way up again to the head disciple who bends over, and the great master is now 90% gone. He says, before you go, before you die, tell us, what do you mean life is a river? So he says, so it's not a river. That's really what philosophy is. There's a point, so it's not a river, right? It doesn't do it anymore. And the other way to understand it is really sleeping with a blanket that's a little too short, right? So something is always sticking out, right? There's no way to get it to cover everything. The Book of Kehelis is the prime example of that. The Shlomo plays the devil's advocate, so to speak, to every philosophical theory. And he points out its weakness. And therefore he says, Sof dover akol nishmo, after we have considered everything, then we have only faith. There is no philosophy that answers all problems. There is no logic. There is no wisdom. The last line is that a person has to have faith. There are things that in life that cannot be explained. We are not privy to all of God's answers. And that great book of Kehelis, which contains so many pearls of wisdom, that was his legacy. Now, the question only is, when did he write this? One opinion is that he wrote the book of Shir HaShirim when he was a young man, and he wrote the book of Proverbs when he was in maturity, and he wrote the book of Kehelis as an old man. But there are midrashim that he wrote all three at the same time in his declining years when he was an old man. Old, relatively speaking, because he only lived to 52. At the end of Solomon's reign, the Jewish empire begins to split. There is already a rebellion from Yerovam. He has lost control. His wives have taken over. According to Jewish tradition, he was driven from the throne, and a pretender sat on the throne for years while he wandered in exile. He does not come to a heroic end. It's sad. And his life story is the forerunner of the impending doom, because the Jewish people never again attain the stature, either spiritually or physically, that they attained at the beginning of his reign. And because of that, therefore, he's a tragic figure in terms of the Jewish people. But he remains a heroic figure because of all the positive things that were done. And from now on, in our discussion of the kings, we'll see that the Jewish commonwealth loses hold. It begins to fritter away all the gains that it had, and instead of becoming strong and mighty, it becomes weak and divided, until eventually it comes to its ultimate doom and destruction, and the problems that are visited thereon.